tonight on Arena. We preview the new Sky drama Then You Run, and we look at the continuing influence of George Lucas's American Graffiti, which turns 50 this year. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And to start this evening, Olesa Zdorevska is a performer, composer and curator from Kyiv in Ukraine. She moved to Ireland in 2011. Her work takes in jazz, Afro-Caribbean, contemporary classical and traditional Ukrainian and Sephardic music, theatre and film. Freedom Letters is her latest project, taking place this Friday evening at the Model Gallery in Sligo as part of this year's Cardia Art Festival. Through music and poetry, it tells the story of two remarkable women, Countess Markovic and Valeria O'Connor-Vilinska, and their involvement in the struggle for independence in Ireland and in Ukraine in the early 20th century. Ukrainian and Irish poets Luby Yamchuk and Mary Branley have written the libretto for a series of imagined letters between the women, and musicians on the night include Salyug Nichanawan, Emer Mayock, Kate Ellis, and Olesa herself will be singing. Delighted that Olesa is with me in studio here in Dublin, while Mary Branley joins us from Sligo. You are the director and I suppose the person whose brainchild this whole project is, Olesa. Where did it start out for you? What was the starting point?
Thanks, Sean, and I'm delighted to be here. And I will answer this question straight away. But the first thing I want to say is, and apologize, it's quite hard. It's a hard time for us today. It was the funeral of a good friend and an amazing writer and human rights activist, Victoria Melina, who came to Dublin a number of times over last year, and she was a close friend, and she died in the missile shelling in Kramatorsk, which happened on the 27th, and she died on Saturday. She was deadly injured. I'm tributing this piece to her. I'm heartbroken, and yet I'm finding strength to talk, because she was all about we need to talk and witness, and our witnessing must come with the responsibility to ensure justice. And from this word, I can start answering your question, because justice was something that I was sort of researching. I was interested in that period, 100 years back, and thank God we have people that write these brilliant articles that kind of reconfirm and find the legacy of women back in the day, sitting in the archives and find this evidence that they also were part of history.
Yes.
And so I found the one about the suffragists of the time from Ukraine, and I found the surname, which was like, oh, this is Irish, O'Connor, but Vilinska, she has this stuff. So I started digging up. There was not much information. She was a playwright. And then I see this, that kind of put the puzzle together for me, this bit of information that was, she was the first woman appointed to the Ukrainian government in 1917, when we sort of gained independence in Ukraine at the time, but we couldn't sustain it just like Ireland did, but we didn't, unfortunately. And okay, I keep thinking, oh, Markovic has this Ukrainian surname, Polish husband who owned land in Ukraine, and I actually have been in that small village. There's no sign of his, the house, the mansion that he had there. But I was like struck by this, and I tried to find evidence if they kind of talked to each other at the time, any correspondence, and of course the archival, it's quite hard to find such evidence anyway.
By the way, why does she have, where does the O'Connor bit come from in
her name? Well, she just had
name?
A father who was doing business in Ukraine at the time, and so she just had an Irish father who lived and worked there, and therefore I was like, okay, there's no evidence of their correspondence, they kind of same age, and they kind of play the same role. Maybe it's a piece. And I thought, okay, let's have these imaginary letters, and I will commission two poets, because obviously I don't work with words, I work with sounds and music, and I'm a composer. So I commissioned two people that I trusted and I knew will do their best at this,
So the idea is that they're an imagined set. There was no real correspondence between them. Well, we couldn't find
any.
But these are imagined letters. And let me bring in Mary Branley in that. As Alessa was explaining to us there, Mary, it is extraordinary that these two women, very much of an age, the Irish connection and the Ukrainian connection, if you like, in reverse, in some ways, mirror images of each other. But the big thing that really struck me, as Alessa was explaining there, was this, the first woman in the Ukrainian parliament. Of course, Countess Markovic, very similar situation for us here in Ireland.
Absolutely. And these were huge achievements for women at the time. So certainly Countess Markovic was first woman appointed to Westminster. And the year before, Valinsko O'Connor had been elected to the Rada.
In Ukraine, which was the parliament at that time in that part of the world. You have a kind of a direct connection to Markovic as well, in terms of your own location and Markovic and a house in that upper in and around Lissadel.
That's right. My house is was actually built by the Gore Boots, the landlords here, in 1903 to be the dispensary for the local tenants to come. So the doctor, the nurse, the dentist came during that time, and actually right up until the 80s, and when it was run by the health centre. So I suppose I'm the first person to live in this house.
Yeah.
But it's, yes, it's on the Gore Booth estate.
Is there a feeling of Countess Markovic around the place?
Well, there is. I mean, honestly, if you close your eyes, you could imagine maybe she's passing the gate on her white horse or something like that. Yeah, this place hasn't changed all that much in 100 years.
Have you visited, Alessa, have you visited Sligo? Have you been to visit that part of the world?
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah. And that's, in fact, how I met Mary, because my partner did a big project, tribute to Dermot Healy, Fool's Errand, setting of the Fool's Errand in Sligo. And Mary was one part of that project. And I get to know her work, and I get to know that she actually is an expert on Markovic herself, because she did a play in 1995. Is that right, Mary?
That's right, yeah.
And I knew before that this is the right person. And I work with Luba. She's an expert of that period in Ukrainian history. And I admire their work so much. So I was very confident. So when I commissioned them, and here's a good and important mention, that Markovic Award, which I got, which is a huge surprise and it's a big deal and a huge honor, could facilitate this happening and could facilitate the research. And I wish it was in times where the war last year disrupted all of my work, and it was really hard to go back to any sort of normality. And it's still very surreal to be here at the radio and hearing all these little adverts and hearing people speaking with happy voices. But that's what we should do. That's what I'm trying to do. It's just a survival mode, because it's actually not in the news what's happening in Ukraine and what's my family experiencing there, my parents and my sister's family and my cousins that are in the army and my friends that are dying. And, you know, it's just this reality we're dealing with. So I suppose in the piece itself, this, all these echoes of the history that oddly repeats again, we hear. Today I was rehearsing one of the numbers of the piece with one of the poets reading, and I couldn't hold the tears, because I felt like, oh, this is about now.
This is
about today. And what we did, we translated the Ukrainian part, Ukrainian letters that read in Ukrainian, and they will be projected on the screen, so the audience will connect through this visual part, because everything was... The text will appear there. There's some archival footage, photographs that I found from both places. So I think it will be quite immersive and informative experience for the audiences who will join us on Friday. And I'm really looking forward to that. Yet I won't lie to you, I find it very challenging to just keep the emotional part of me together.
Particularly today, given the death of your friend, the funeral of your friend today, it cannot be easy to be even sitting here speaking to us. But Mary, to go to the structure of the piece, and it's kind of four acts isn't quite the right way to put it, but there are four sections in terms of these imagined letters between the character of Countess Markovic, the person of Countess Markovic, and Valeria O'Connor Vilinska. Lockout, rising, prison, and then the final section, War of Independence and Civil War. These are specific moments, are turning points in the life of Countess Markovic?
Well, certainly it all kicked off with the lockout. Markovic had been an activist, or involved in so many different political strands at the time, you know, the suffragette, the workers' rights, the this, the that, the other. I think the lockout brought a clarity to just what they were up against at the time to try and win something for workers' rights. So that was a shock, I think, for all of them. The baton charge by the police, etc., people killed, so many injured. Markovic herself actually was beaten up that day. So I think that fixed her mind just how threatened the authorities were by this mass movement that Connolly had started and Larkin.
And you make your way then through rising prison and the War of Independence.
Yes, so it immediately, yes, because immediately they said, we've got to get our own army. So they're really into the militancy at that point. And they were planning the rising. And of course, Markovic was training the Fianna boys throughout, gun running, etc. So was, you know, she was heavily involved for years. Yeah. And then it was Connolly who appointed her then into the Irish Citizen Army to have her own command with Mallon at the College at Stephen's Green in the College of Surgeons. And no just, other woman had a command, I don't think.
Yeah. And just to try to draw some parallels, I mean, particularly in those opening sections, I guess, in Rising and in the forming of an army, were there parallels with O'Connor Wilinska in that case?
Yeah, exactly. And this is what we're trying to show. When I was curating, I had to, because the amount of amazing material we could work with and these parallels and just that history and so much to talk about it. But, so it's about the history of both of our places, kind of chronological way, trying to see those parallels. It's about the women themselves and their lives, actually, personal lives and what they were dealing with. So it has a lot of layers, and every Ukrainian part is sort of, which is interspersed, every letters that come one through another and through songs that we sang also in the piece. And the I can't play you any music yet. The world premiere was happened on Friday, and with the musicians there, we'll be playing it publicly for the very first time. But there are some a cappella pieces, and there's a lot in it. So I would
there's a lot of music,
and, come
and
over
some of the letters will be read over music and that type of thing. So there is
On. Music serves it's sort of as it's not an bed. Opera and it's not a theater. Yeah. There's no acting in it. There's narrators the who are the voices of these women who are the authors of this text piece.
Yes. Yeah, but before we started, you did sing us a song which has a wonderfully, I must say, there's huge emotional feeling of it, a huge sadness within. What is the song, and maybe tell us where it fits into the piece?
So basically it's a song from that period, which is an equivalent of the Dark Horse, if you know Liam Weldon's Dark Horse on the Wind, which Salag will be singing, and the melody is hauntingly similar. So when I put these two songs together, we sing it in the canon simultaneously. So she sings the
Salag
verse from the Irish, that song. I'm singing the verse from Do You Hear Me, Brother, which was kind of an anthem of Ukrainian rebellion, of our citizen army. And then we sing them together, and you can hear that this is one thing. We can hear that we both of our nations went through the same story.
So that you might sing a little bit of the Ukrainian song for us right now. And just this is from that period, is it?
So it's from
that 1920s period.
Yeah, a little bit even earlier than that, 1917 till 1921. So the lyrics were written a bit earlier and the music followed. And then it's considered like a folk song, but actually it has two composers, the composer and the author of the lyrics. Do you want to hear it?
Yes, if you could hear some of it now. Thanks.
Чуєш, брате мій, товаришу мій, відлітають сірим шнуром журавлі у вирі, кличуть кру-кру-кру.
Wonderful sadness within the body of that song.
And I can see the cranes that are flying.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what is it? Could you give me a rough translation of what the lyrics are talking about?
Do you hear
about?
me, uh, do you hear the brother or all these cranes that are flying away? And they calling us.
Crying as they leave.
They're calling us, and where are they going? And so this path is all blurred in my eyes, but I have to keep going.
You know, in some ways, Mary, as I listen to that and Alessa's translation of it, there's a sense of the wild geese and the cry of the wild geese. I know that's a different period in history, but you do get this, and there's a wonderful sense even within the music of that Shannos kind of the old queen in our own tradition.
I'm sure it is very much of a king. Yes, yeah, this is it.
I'm sure you could hear that aspect in there too, Mary.
Well, certainly today, Salog brought that forward very much in the rehearsals. She was singing a famine song, Johnny Shoiga. And again, it's this, you know, the families are being evicted. They're out on the road. This is heading one direction and it's not good. So there's this incredible, sorrow and sadness in the music. But there's also, I think, the telling of a story about these powerful women and what they did and how much they served the causes and for everybody.
Just one final thing as we finish up then, Mary. Obviously, Countess Marshkevich has her critics, and I'm sure you're aware of that in the writing of the Freedom Letters. How did you handle that side of things and sometimes those criticisms that are given to her, particularly in and around her class as much as anything else?
Yes, absolutely. I, you know, she had sworn enemies even in the time, and certainly afterwards, people piled on, you know, all sorts of layers after her death and in the decades that followed. But if I just remember Sean O'Casey, who really couldn't stand her, but I could understand as well why, because she would probably sweep into a room, you know, and interrupt everyone and everything and sort of take over. I'd say she did have that kind of energy.
Yeah.
And, you know, the people are like, where is this one coming from? And maybe she was there in the ball gown from Dublin Castle. And it's like, what is happening here? She's not one of us. Who is she really? But even he said she had tremendous energy and she was fearless.
Well, so listen,
there was that grudging admiration. And I think she proved herself
in time
to thousands and thousands of Dublin people who lined out for her funeral. At the end of her life.
Well, it does sound like a fascinating project. It's called Freedom Letters. It takes place at 8 p.m. This Friday, the 7th of July, at the Model in Sligo as part of the Carja Arts Festival. You'll get full details on carjafestival.com. And I think it is a lovely thing that you're doing, Alessa, here to dedicate the performance to your friend Victoria Amelina, and our sympathies to you and obviously to her family and friends. She was buried today, and thank you so much for coming
and
speaking to us at such a difficult time. Gorama Gutfein. Thank you very much to Alessa, and thank you to Mary in Sligo as well. Then You Run is a new 8-part drama that begins on Sky TV this Thursday. It follows the misadventures of four friends whose dreams of the perfect summer holiday spiral into a dark and perilous adventure after they inadvertently cross paths with some of the most dangerous people in Europe. It's dark, it's violent, and very, very twisty. Very strong Irish cast, it has to be said here. And here to talk about Then You Run is Alan Carr of RTE, the RTE Entertainment website. There are a couple of strands to this, Alan, but let's just describe the opening sequence to me, which I have to say, I thought, what's going on here? I felt it was in a Jo Nesbø book, initially, at any rate.
Yeah, kind of. It's a very good setup. I mean, this is the new British-German thriller miniseries based on the 2014 novel You by Croatian-German writer Zoran Drivenka. And it's about four young London girls who are coming to the end of their school term. School's out forever. It's their last year in school and they want to take a holiday. Three of them want to go off on a sun holiday. However, one of them, Tara O'Rourke, who's played by the Limerick actor Leo McNamara, who was in Normal People, she wants to go and see her estranged father in Rotterdam. However, her other friends are keen on going elsewhere and having a good time, and they fall out over this, right? Now, they're four very, very different people, very contrasting characters. They're young, they're rebellious, they're party animals. So Tara goes off on her own to Rotterdam, where she meets her estranged father, Oren, who was played by Cork actor Cillian O'Sullivan. And almost from the very start, you can tell something is going to go terribly wrong.
I was even upset before that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's a little bit of, but then there was this bit where suddenly we were in 2005 and we have a fella driving in a car and we haven't a clue who he is.
Yeah.
What happens in this sequence?
This is very strange. Well, this is all going on. This is a misadventure with the four girls and these dodgy kind of European drug dealers. There's almost a different strand to this programme. It almost turns into a separate show. Now, this is about the Traveller, who is an incredibly prolific serial killer who's been prowling, you know, the train network and the road networks of Europe over the past 10 years, offing people sometimes 10 at a time in the most ingenious and horrible of manner. So, you know, just mostly while they're asleep.
Yeah.
So we cut between the four young girls getting into these kind of very dark waters with these shady characters. And then we cut back to the Traveller. And you just know, sooner or later, paths are going to cross sooner or later.
Yeah.
So I can understand why you might feel slightly cautious.
You are waiting for that to happen. I'm going to play a clip because let's get a sense. So that's a very dark, and that was the Yo Nesbo, because it starts in a very snowy motorway and they all sleep overnight and then horrible things happen to all the people sleeping in the cars around the Traveller. So that was the Yo Nesbo bit that I was referring to. Then you have these four young women. Tara, Nessie, Stink and Ruth, that's the four names?
That's the four women, four young women, and they are very, very different. Tara is, as I say, played by Leon McNamara from Limerick. Vivian O'Parara is a rebellious Stink, and she was in I May Destroy You, the very good BBC drama a few years ago. Yasmin Monet-Prince is a sensible Ruth. The newcomer is Adora Fairhurst is the very loyal and innocent Nessie. They're a real gang.
Yeah.
But all they do is row, as gangs do.
Well, let's have a listen to a typical row. This is them rowing about where they should go, as you've mentioned, on their end of school holiday.
Maybe we don't have to go to Zante. What if we came to you?
Our end of school holiday in Ireland.
I won't be in Ireland.
Well, where will you be?
Rotterdam.
The place they sell weed in the coffee shops?
That's Amsterdam.
Is that the place with the red light district?
No, that's Amsterdam.
Wow! It's not looking good so far, is it? What is in Rotterdam?
The biggest commercial port in Europe?
My dad. He's lived there for years.
You want to go there, don't you? Do you even want us to come visit you?
Yeah.
And why didn't Daddy come to the funeral today, might I ask?
Stink.
He can't be bothered to bury his own mother. He can't be bothered to show up for your whole life since the crash where your mum actually died. But as soon as he clicks his fingers, you come running.
There we go. Stink. Which of them did you say is it? Is it Yasmin who plays? No, it isn't. It's Vivian
O'Parara.
She's the one who plays Stink.
She's Stink, and she's the leader of the pack, but she's extremely rebellious.
Yeah, she very much is. And then the other three, Leah McNamara as the daughter, Tara, with the Irish connection. You hear it in the name, and you hear her saying there that she's possibly heading off to Ireland. Yasmin Monet-Prince and Isadora Fairhurst as the other.
As the newcomer,
The other of the quartet. The Irish connection here, it's quite large right across the casting.
I must say I wasn't aware of the Irish connection before I started watching this. And it's quite jarring to hear these very strong...
Did you find... Oh, I was delighted to hear
them. No, it's delighted. It's jarring and delighted, Sean, to hear these very strong Dublin accents in these kind of continental settings. But that's the Irish, I suppose, you know. So, huge Irish cast. And I think that the name that's going to jump out to everyone is Frances McGee.
Yeah.
Who, of course, chewed the scenery and spat it back into her face is an RT crime drama Kin over the last season. He plays Turi. He's a gang henchman, a strong arm when things go wrong. And now I've only seen the first three episodes, Sean, and he doesn't have a hell of a lot to do so far, except glare, I suppose. But this is the kind of drama where seemingly minor characters suddenly take on these pivotal roles. So who knows what might happen with Frances and McGee here.
Yeah.
Liam McNamara is great as Tara. There's also Cillian O'Sullivan as Oren.
Yeah, but let's stick with Frances McGee for a minute, because he's also, that you talk about him being a henchman, he's a henchman to Regan, who is Tara's uncle.
Yes.
Played by Richard Coyle. This is a dark group of people, this bundle of men.
These are very, very bad people. All is not what it seems. Oren is saying that he's a music producer, but he's got something going on in his swimming pool, which is locked to his daughter. So it's out of bounds. You pretty much gather that these people are involved in a European drug cartel.
Let's have a listen to a clip that features the aforementioned Richard Coyle as Regan. And at the very end of it, the character of Turi, played by Frances McGee. They're trying to find out from the less than bright henchmen around the place how much of his drugs have been nicked. And as I say, it's Frances McGee from, you might recognise him as Uncle Bren from Kin. You'll hear him at the end.
How much was the yield?
The what?
The yield of the crop projected.
Fuckload.
A fuckload.
It was a shit ton, Lee.
Oh, which was it now, boys? A shit ton or a fuckload? Gun to the head.
More of a fuckload, I suppose.
I must say it's a comfort to know I have such fine clerical minds on the case.
400 grams per 400 watt lamp gives us a total theoretical yield of 28 kilos for the entire crop. More or less €450,000 worth of weed gone to fucking shit.
My apologies, I should have warned you about the language in that clip. Then you run Frances McGee at the very end of it there, and it was Richard Coyle playing the character of Regan at the beginning. This is from the new Sky drama, Then You Run. Alan Carr has been watching it for us. Now, this is where I was talking to you before we started, Alan, about, for me, I'm wondering about the tonal, some tonal issues, if I can put it that way. If you listen to the clip between the four young women, the four girls at the beginning, this is a kind of a young adult kind of coming of age drama. They're not going to Ireland. They're heading off to Rotterdam. When you listen to that, it's in the same mode as Kin, in fact. It's very, very, very dark. And you have the Yo Nesbo stuff with the traveller. You have the kind of black comedy with the girls. And then you have the straightforward drug dealing with the men. Is there a lot going on here? Are the strands, you've seen three episodes, are they starting to knit together in a
very
way?
Very, very much so. And that's what I enjoy about it. So I have been enjoying about it that you have the traveller, the serial killer. Mm. You have the four young girls who are getting way out of their depth. And you have this kind of European drug cartel with a huge kind of Irish membership that is getting up to very, very bad things. And I think the leader of this whole thing is Richard Coyle as Regan. He is just fantastic in this. He glowers with menace. So tonally, I think it really works. And those three different tonal strands you talk about, they start to converge. They start to kind of separate and then they come back together again. But the whole time, the traveller is circling somewhere out there in the snowy vastness, you know, waiting to pounce.
See, I think the first time we see him is in 2005. The second time we see him, it's 2010. So we're
coming closer all the time.
We're making our way up to 2020,
precisely. So
whatever.
Totally, I think it works very well in that respect.
Yeah, so it does link together like that. However, there is, at the heart of this, there's a father-daughter relationship that needs to be mended.
Yeah.
Great performances here from both. You've already mentioned Leah McNamara as Tara, and a Cork actor, Killian O'Sullivan, playing the character of the father, Oren. Mm. What kind of dynamic is between the father-daughter?
Well, as we've learned there from the clip you played earlier on, when she was very young, Tara and her father, Oren, and her mother and her his wife were in a car crash. Unfortunately, she died, and Oren split. He disappeared after that. And Tara, you might say she has that awful expression, daddy issues. And that's why she
wants
to.
She's brought up by her grandmother. That's the funeral they're talking about at the top.
Exactly. So, you know, that's, you know, Oren's mother. He didn't even attend the funeral, as we learned just there. So he is this guy who says he's a musician. In fact, he's been long listed for two Ivor Novello Awards, he says at one point. But it's all an artifice. He lives in this gorgeous house outside Rotterdam. It's very Frank Lloyd Wright kind of place out in the forest, you know.
Beautiful cars, collects cars,
a lot of money. But it's all an artifice. Underneath that charismatic, confidence exterior, he's a very conflicted individual. He's full of shame, but not just about deserting his daughter, but also about a lot of other stuff, a lot of other baggage that we learn about as we go along.
Let's have a listen to a clip between the two of them then. Oren, Killian O'Sullivan showing his daughter Tara, Leah McNamara, around his very cool, it has to be said,
beautiful,
eco-friendly, perfectly designed house. But what's going on inside it, that's another thing.
The glass was made using sand from the dunes. The designer is a mate of mine from Berlin, and she calls it Außen Innen, which means...
outside, inside.
Very good. Anyway, the whole place is certified sustainable. Super eco, if you will.
Guess you make up for it with the cars.
Ouch. You got me there. Now, I wanted your room to feel special. Yours, like. So. Why, you don't like it?
I mean, if I was 9.
Oh, my God. I'm...
No, it's okay. I'm joking.
I didn't know. I'll change it. I promise.
There you go. That's Cillian O'Sullivan as Oren and Leah McNamara as Sarah. Of course, he's got all these pink cuddly toys, which would be great for a 9-year-old, but not for a...
she's 19, 20.
Yeah, heading into her 20s at this point. But you get a sense in that from the Leah McNamara character there when she translates the little bit of the language. And she does that later on in a very disturbing scene.
Oh, yes.
Where she translates something into Dutch or German, whichever.
More bad language. Yeah. In German, off Deutsch, obvious.
Again, very, very dark stuff.
Yeah.
The casting here is quite across all the different aspects, the traveller, the drug gang, and the four young women.
Very, very much so. Four young women in this are absolutely fantastic. At the start, I thought I wasn't going to like them at all, but after the first couple of minutes, I began to care what happened to them. Their dialogue is fast-paced, very kind of like bam, bam, bam. It's littered with slang words I've never heard of, silly street. But then again, I'm very old and I don't live in London. But Leah McNamara is great. Cillian O'Sullivan is great. Leah is great. But for me, it's Richard Coyle as Reagan. He really kind of takes over the whole show, I think. You know, he's got his own brand of very choice Dublinese curse words. Ball bag being a favourite.
Please don't go too much further than ball bag.
Well,
thank
okay,
you.
But he's got some good one-liners. Like, you're about as useful as a back pocket on a shirt.
Later on,
he muses, I'm a man with an appetite for destruction, and he's given to casual violence, and he really is magnetic. But great casting throughout, I think, and not just the Irish actors, but everyone, I think.
Yeah, there's another point where he looks at a corpse and he says to the corpse, even in death, you're shocking good looking. You're the best looking man in the room. Yeah, he does get some of the greatest. You enjoyed this.
I really did. I'm looking forward to the next 5 episodes. It starts this Friday on Sky TV. I think it's clever, it's dark, and it's just very wrong, Sean. Wrong, if that's the word.
Clever, dark and wrong.
Wrong, yeah.
Yeah, but in a good way is what you're
very
saying.
Very much so.
Okay, that's Alan Carr speaking to us. I'll double check whether, I'm not sure whether it's Thursday or Friday. I think it might be Thursday it starts. We'll double check that during the ad break. Does it start on Thursday or Friday? But that is Alan Carr. High recommendation for Then You Run, the new Sky TV drama. Now, festivals. Oh, by the way, Friday evening it is for sure for the Sky show that we were speaking about before the break. Then You Run, Friday evening on Sky. Now, festival season is upon us. The Galway International Arts Festival runs from the 17th through to the 30th of July. We will be broadcasting 2 shows from there in the first week of the festival. That's on the Thursday and the Friday, July the 20th and July the 21st. But in the second week of the festival, we'll be back in Galway for a very special event. It's on Thursday the 27th. We have an audience with Druid Theatre Company at the Town Hall Theatre, and this is celebrating their new production of Druid O'Casey. You are invited to come along. The Druid O'Casey trilogy, the 3 Sean O'Casey plays, The Plough and the Stars, The Shadow of the Gunman and Juno and the Paycock, will be performed during the festival, and then it heads out on a national and international tour. But on Thursday, July the 27th, at 3 p.m. in the Town Hall Theatre, we'll be joined by the creative team behind Druid O'Casey. Director Gary Hines will be with us, and some of the cast members as well, including Catherine Walsh, Marty Ray, Rory Nolan, Hilda Fay and Zara Devlin. We'll chat to them, the director and the creative team, about the whole process of bringing Druid O'Casey to the stage, the importance of the work and the play's contemporary resonances. Real opportunity then, if you're lucky enough to have tickets for the shows, to whet your appetite, or if you don't have tickets, an opportunity to explore the themes and the theatricality of these much loved plays. That's an Arena Druid O'Casey special from the Town Hall Theatre Galway on Thursday, July the 27th, 3 to 4 p.m. To find out details of how to get your tickets, go to druid.ie. By 1983, with producer and director credits under his belt that included Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back and The Raiders of the Lost Ark, George Lucas was established as one of the most successful movers and shakers in Hollywood. But a decade earlier, he struggled to get a movie made, even for a budget of less than $1 million. However, with the vision and determination that any young director needs in spades, he finally saw his cherished project come to life, his second film, American Graffiti, a movie that centred around his two great passions as a teenager in the 1950s, cars and music. Stephen Benedict is with us this evening to have a look at the impact of this film. But it really was a film, Stephen, that almost never got made.
Nobody wanted to make it. I wouldn't say his mentor, but his great champion was Francis Ford Coppola. Coppola had set up a studio in the late 1960s in San Francisco called Zoetrope. They had a deal with Warner Brothers. The first movie that out of the hatch from that deal was THX-1138, which was George Lucas's first film. It absolutely tanked at the box office, and Warner Brothers cancelled the contracts. And Coppola then said, look, George, you're a really, really talented filmmaker. Why don't you go off and make something with a lot of heart? And Lucas said, OK, I'll try that. So he went off and he decided to sit down and write a movie about his youth. And, you know, he turned 18 in 1962, and that is the year in which American Graffiti is set. And as you said, it's about his two great passions. His greatest passion, actually, as a young man, was motor car racing. He wanted to be a drag racer. In actual fact, he was racing, he had yet to turn pro. But then in the summer of 1962, just before he graduated from college, just before he graduated from high school, he had a near fatal car crash. The car spun out of control, flipped, rolled and smashed into a tree. The only reason why he survived is because his safety belt broke. It snapped.
Wow.
He was recovering in hospital, and he literally had an epiphany. He said, I'm going to stop drag racing. I'm going to go to college. And it was only in college at the age of 18 and 19 that he discovered cinema.
Let's have a listen to George Lucas talking about why he wanted to make this film.
I guess the anthropologist side of me never went away, and I was very interested in the whole innocence of the 50s, the mating rituals of the 50s, the uniquely American mating rituals of meeting the opposite sex in cars was very fascinating to me. I really liked this kind of lost ritual that had gone on in the United States between 1940 and basically the beginning of the 60s. And I saw the beginning of the 60s as a real transition in the culture because of the Vietnam War and all the things we were going through. I had always liked Fellini's film, Evita Leoni, which is kind of the same issue about growing up. And I wanted to make a movie about it.
That's George Lucas talking about the reasons that he wanted to make American Graffiti. Stephen Benedict looking at the 50-year-old film with us this evening. To what extent then, Stephen, is he telling his own story here?
To a large degree, yes. There's three principal male characters. Harrison Ford is the first introduction for a lot of audiences to Harrison Ford, but he didn't play the main character.
Yeah.
You can really split it between Ron Howard's character, Stevie, and then Richard Dreyfuss. And Lucas played...
Who were practically unknown at the time?
Nobodies.
Yeah.
So he split his personality or his story between those two guys. One of them is very, very much a button-down collar, stay-at-home guy, which is Ron Howard's character, and Richard Dreyfuss's character, who's supposed to go to college but won't.
Yeah.
And that's the whole dilemma that night. It's a graduating night, and he's been given a $2,000 check by the Grand Lodge of the local elders of the town, which is Modesto, California, which is where Lucas grew up, and he decides not to go. And all through the night, it's, you've got to go, you've got to go. And I'm not spoiling the ending. He has to leave. He has to leave the story. He has to leave his hometown, which is, I'm not making too grandiose a statement upon this. It goes back to Joyce and Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man, because that's what Lucas was doing. He's portraying himself as a young man. And as we know in Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man, he has a great line, fly by these gnats, he has to leave. And if you think about all the films that have been influenced by American Graffiti, I'm thinking about films like Booksmart and Superbad, even John Carney's great film Sing Street, the characters have to leave.
They have to go. Let's have a listen to that opening scene, which which gives us a sense of the dilemma, in fact. Richard Dreyfuss as Kurt here, Ron Howard as Steve, Charles Martin Smith as Terry outside the diner, and Kurt is having doubts about the future that has been outlined for him.
Hey, what do you say, Kurt? Last night in town, you guys gonna have a little bash before you leave?
Moose have been looking for you all day. He got worried, thought you were trying to avoid him or something.
What is it? What do you got?
Oh, great.
That's $2,000, man. $2,000!
Mr. Jennings gave it to me to give to you. He says he's sorry it's so late, but it's the first scholarship the Moose Lodge has given out. And he says they're all very proud of you back at the Lowell.
Listen, I don't think I'm going to be going tomorrow.
Come on, what are you talking about?
Well, I was thinking I could wait a year, you know, go to city for a while.
You chicken thing.
Oh, wait a minute. After all we went through to get accepted, we're finally getting out of this turkey town, and now you want to crawl back into your cell, right?
You want to end up like John. You just can't stay 17 forever.
It's
You've
just,
got to get
I
that
need,
through your
I
head.
I just need some time.
Just need some time. Richard Jeffers as Kurt, and we also heard Ron Howard as Steve, Charles Martin Smith as Terry in the opening scene of American Graffiti, which is 50 years old this year. And it is quite, when you look at that cast, they were, as you say, practical unknowns at the time, as was Harrison Ford.
More of a carpenter.
Yeah, he was still a carpenter at that point in time. And shoestring budget, $700,000. Did it make a lot of money?
Oh, it made a fortune, Sean. It made $140 million at the American box office. And the funny thing is, the studio, firstly, didn't want to make it.
Yeah.
When they saw the final product, they said, this film is unreleasable. We can't even show it on television. It was only Francis Ford Coppola, who had earned over $1 million off the success of The Godfather at that time.
Yeah.
He produced it. He said in the screening, he berated the executives at Universal Studios and says, you should be down on your knees worshipping and thanking this man for what he's made. And if you guys don't think it's a good picture, I'll cut you a check for $1 million to buy the movie back. And it was only then, at Coppola's passion, that they said, actually, we might be onto something here. And then they released it, and all of a sudden the audience proved it to be a hit. The audience recognised its importance.
And now we'll come back to the cars in a minute and Harrison Ford, but there is another huge element to the music plays a huge part in it, but it also changed the way music was used and the business of music in films. Let's have a listen to a little mashup of some of the music that you'll hear within it.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10.
We're back up in the woods among the evergreens. There stood a log cabin made of earth and wood. Where lived a country boy named Johnny B.
Ah, you say you're gonna leave. You know it's a lie, cause that'll be the day when I die.
Rock and roll's been going downhill ever since Buddy Holly died.
Don't you think the Beach Boys are boss?
Let's go surfing now. Everybody's learning how. Come on a safari with me.
Bill Haley, Chuck Berry, Buddy Holly, and then the Beach Boys with a little clip from the film in the midst of all of that. That's from American Graffiti. I mean, it was a jukebox in some ways for that change from the 50s into the 60s in terms of the music that's in there, Stephen.
Absolutely, and that's the way that George Lucas actually wrote the screenplay originally. He co-wrote it with two other writers at the end, but when he was writing the outline and the scenario for it, he chose specific songs to go with each scene.
Yeah.
And, you know, Martin Scorsese, when he's putting together Goodfellas, did the same thing. Quentin Tarantino does it all the time. Wes Anderson's the same. Edgar Wright's the same. But I think that we heard the best line in the whole movie there. Rock and Roll's been going downhill ever since Buddy Holly died.
Yeah.
And then the young girl, Carol, chimes in. Don't you think the Beach Boys are boss? Because that's the transition. Because she's only 3 years younger than John Miller in the car. And for her, Buddy Holly's old. Buddy Holly is dead. So, and the great thing also to remember is that the movie takes place smack in the middle of the Kennedy presidency. In June of 62, Kennedy's inauguration in January 61, his assassination in November 63. So this is the halcyon days. This is the beautiful golden age of Camelot. It doesn't get much better than this. And it's the transition, because we've also got to take into account within, I think, 8 months of Kennedy's, within a short time in 1964, the Beatles appeared on Ed Sullivan's show in February 64. So there's phenomenal changes going through. And
all
that's really
happening.
What the story's all about, transitions.
Yeah, and but there's another aspect to the use of music in the film, which is the business aspect of it. I mean, if you even played what we just played now, if you even played even just that amount of those songs, the film would have a budget that would go well above $700,000.
Yeah, I shudder to think. But the amazing thing is that the movie not only gives you samples, it gives you almost all of the songs, which is unheard of. But licensing rights, music rights to movies was actually unheard of back in the 70s. Most of the revenue streams came from radio plays, record sales, or touring. So Lucas got it for a song. I think $90,000 was his music budget. The only person missing was Elvis Presley.
And was that a money decision?
I'm sure Colonel Parker had a little bit to say about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, that changed.
Enormously.
Did that affect the licensing laws around the use of music
in
films?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about, you know, amongst the most popular, most successful songs of all time, Stand By Me is a song that was actually used as a title for a film. And despite the fact that that movie Stand By Me being set in 1959, Stand By Me, the song, wasn't released until 1961 or 62. But nobody cares, right? So the thing is, I mean, if you think also about the way Levi's advertising in the 1980s picked up on the beautiful songs from the 50s and 60s. I remember buying my first pair of 501s because of those songs. It wasn't because of the commercial, it was the songs. I wanted to be like those kids in the 50s and 60s.
That's your thing, you wanted the song that your man had in the ad. That was where you bought the Levi's. I know people who did buy them for that reason. However, let us move swiftly on to the racing the cars aspect of things. Yeah. Harrison Ford here, I mean, even from this opening moment in his film career, he just has it on screen.
Yeah, because he played a little bit of a sultry character. Everyone else was young and innocent and optimistic, and he was the guy who'd been doing the circuit for far too long, cruising the strip around the town of Modesto. And, you know, that's what Lucas used to do himself. But as you were saying, the great thing about the music is that the way we hear the music in the film is the way the characters hear it, in the cars.
Yeah.
So music was mobile and it carried you from one point to another destination, and it carried you through your emotional journey. So it's like an emotional jukebox. That's what the movie really
is. Yeah, let's have a listen to a clip with John LaMatta's John and Mackenzie Phillips's car. She's the younger girl that we heard in the scene earlier on. And they're driving along in the car, and who comes along but Bob Falfta. How do we say his name?
LaFalfa.
Yeah. Harrison Ford, the character here.
I've been looking all over for you, man. Didn't nobody tell you I was looking for you?
Hey, I can't keep track of all you punks running around here backwards.
Hey, you're supposed to be the fast thing in the valley, man, but that can't be your car. It must be your mama's car. I'm sort of embarrassed to be this close to you.
Yeah, well, I'm not surprised driving a field car.
Field car? What's field car?
Field car runs through the fields, drops cow shit all over the place to make the lettuce grow.
That's pretty good. Hey, I like the color of your car there, man. What's that supposed to be? Sort of a cross between piss yellow and puke green, ain't it?
Well, you call that a paint job, but it's pretty ugly. I bet you got to sneak up on the pumps just to get a little air in your tires.
Well, at least I don't have to pull over to the side just to let a funeral go by, man.
Oh, funny. You know what?
Your car's uglier than I am. That didn't come out right.
Of course, it didn't come out right. There we have John LaMatta as John, Mackenzie Phillips as Carol, and Harrison Ford in the other car in a scene from American Graffiti. What I was saying as that was playing, you got to think they're in the car now.
Yeah.
They're not in a railway, not on a train anymore. The car has become the mode of transport.
That's it. The train was the number one mode of transport in the early 20th century. Transitioned after World War II to the motor car. But the brilliant thing about this is the diner isn't your classical diner.
Yeah.
But it is it's shaped like a spaceship. And if you think about George Lucas's next film. Okay,
yeah.
So it was actually part of the architectural design style of California in the 1940s and 50s, all because of the UFO sighting in 1947.
Yeah, so Close Encounters was yeah. on the way.
Yeah.
All right, so Stephen, thanks so much for that. That's Stephen Benedict speaking to us about American Graffiti, hugely successful, hugely influential George Lucas film. It turns 50, believe it or not, this year. And that is our lot for this Wednesday evening. Amandine Passo-Devine and Paula Shields researched. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Harry Buchlis was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. Great interview for you tomorrow night. I'll be talking to Celine Song about her award winning film Past Lives, which I adored when I saw it recently, so looking forward to talking to her about that. That's tomorrow night. John Creedon will be with you after the news.